Welcome to Weekend Ag Matters from the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network. Join us for an in-depth look at Iowa agriculture. Here are your hosts, Dustin Hoffman and Anna Haster.
Thanks for tuning in to Weekend Ag Matters here on the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network. I'm Anna Hastert, your host for the weekend. If you listen to Weekend Ag Matters on a regular basis, you've noticed that Dustin and I take turns hosting each weekend, and this weekend's technically supposed to be Dustin's weekend to host, but I went ahead and stole his thunder, and I'm actually going to host this entire first segment by myself. So bear with me, we can do this. A couple things worth noting from this past week. One, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement passed out of the U.S. Senate Finance Committee. This was a big step for this piece of legislation, which now heads to the Senate floor. The Senate will pass this piece of legislation if the articles of impeachment do not reach them first. That will be key in keeping this legislation moving forward and onto President Trump's desk. Another thing worth noting, Chinese officials confirmed that they will be in town next week to sign the first phase of the U.S.-China trade agreement. They'll be in town the 13th through the 15th, so it's assumed that they will still sign the agreement on the original agreed-to date, January 15th. We'll make sure to update you throughout the week next week as to what's going on, when that official signing date will be, and hopefully be able to provide you a little bit more insight as to what the Chinese are planning in regards to purchasing U.S. agricultural products moving forward. So the reason that I chose to host this first segment by myself this week is because I collected a great interview at the National Association of Farm Broadcaster Convention back in November. I know that was a little while ago, but the content still pertains to producers today. So I'm going to kick it over to Dr. Peggy Thompson, who is professional services veterinarian with Boehringer Ingelheim, who talks about bovine viral diarrhea virus. Now, this virus impacts a lot of cattle producers, sometimes without their knowledge. Joined here today at the 2019 Trade Talk with Dr. Peggy Thompson. She is with Boehringer Ingelheim. We're talking about bovine viral diarrhea virus. Can you tell us a little bit more about this virus?
Absolutely. So BVDV, as the name says, bovine viral diarrhea virus, is a disease that affects any and all ages of cattle. And the main thing I would say that disease does is it suppresses the immune system of those cattle. And that can lead to issues with respiratory disease or pneumonia in your calves. It could also lead to reproductive issues where you can have abortions in your cow herd.
And what are some of the symptoms of this virus? How can producers detect it within their herd?
BVD is one of those diseases that can really be silent and creep up on you without you knowing it. Some of the clinical signs are really nonspecific. Producers could look for, anytime you've got cattle, they're depressed or off feed or showing signs of respiratory disease, certainly BVD could be a piece of that problem. Again, if producers are seeing more incidences of abortion or incidences of, early embryonic death, BVD would want to, be top of the list of things to look at. The issue with BVD, the main issue with BVD, is the formation of PI calves. And I really think not everybody understands that process. And so what happens is that cow, when she's pregnant, she gets exposed to that BVD virus. That virus crosses the placenta and infects that calf. And because that calf isn't completely formed yet, its immune system doesn't know to fight off the disease, if that makes sense. And so that calf can be born persistently infected with that virus. We call them PI calves, but what they are is they're the Typhoid Mary. They're just constantly spreading that BVD virus to the rest of your herd mates. And producers were told, and veterinarians thought years ago, that we could look at that calf, right? Because he's born with a virus, so you would think that he or she would look different from the rest of the herd. What we're finding out is that those calves look just as healthy as cattle that aren't infected. So that can be really challenging for producers to know if they have BVD on their operation. That's where testing can come in.
And are there any options for prevention of this virus?
Yeah, when we talk about BVD, it's such a challenging disease, and again, it can be silent and grab you without your knowledge. To me, it's threefold as far as how we control this disease. So the first thing to do would be to test your cattle, and you really want to remove any PI cattle that you find. And producers should work with their veterinarians, but blood samples or ear notches would work to test. So to me, that would be first, to find and eliminate what you may have. Secondly would be, biosecurity. A lot of producers may not have BVD on their operation, but the potential for them to bring it into their operation with the purchase of new cattle could really be high. And so producers need to test any bulls that they're buying so that they don't bring it in. Any bred animals, that would might be something that you want to test, those animals. And then just keeping a strict eye on what and who's around you. And then the third part of that is obviously vaccination. And a vaccination, as we know, is certainly a great tool to help us prevent BVD. I would certainly want producers to work with their veterinarians on the best protocol as far as how to prevent that BVD infection.
Yeah, and Boehringer Ingelheim does have a vaccination for this virus. Can you tell us a little bit more about that product?
Yes, absolutely. Right now at BI, we have a product that's called Express FP. This is a modified live vaccine that's labeled for the prevention of these PI calves. That would be something that you would use pre-breeding, but again, very important to work with your vet on where that fits and strategic timing and placement of that vaccine. The other vaccine we have is Pyramid 5, and Pyramid 5 is our respiratory calf vaccine. And that would be maybe something for producers to consider when they're thinking about pre-weaning and weaning vaccinations, getting those cattle ready for the next stage in their life. What we're seeing with BVD right now is a strain that we haven't seen as much, that's really continuing to grow, and it has grown over the past 20 years. And that strain is called type 1B. And if we look at cattle and diagnose BVD, we are finding that strain 1B 78% of the time. So that really is, in my opinion, something that needs to be on the radar of cattle producers. With Express FP and Pyramid 5, we are labeled for helping in prevention of that BVD type 1B strain.
All right, Dr. Thompson, that was all the questions I had for you. Anything else you'd like to add in regards to BVD?
With BVD, again, I just really think it's important for producers to know that vaccines are very helpful, but they're not the only part of how to control the disease, and monitoring and testing and trying to keep biosecurity strict and secure would be another big piece of controlling that disease.
You guys, I thank you for bearing with me for this opening segment by myself. I'm sure you missed Dustin, but if you stay tuned, you can hear him in the segment coming up next.
Welcome to January. We made it to 2020. While we don't know what the year will bring, we try to be prepared. The same is true when you're traveling in winter conditions. Always be aware of the forecasts and driving conditions along the complete route you plan to take. Allow yourself extra time and drive according to conditions. Be prepared with a winter survival kit in your car. Be safe when you're driving this winter. If you're not comfortable, stay home or get a ride. And check road conditions across Iowa by calling 511 on your cell phone or downloading the Iowa 511 app. This message from the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network.
Welcome back to Weekend Ag Matters. Here's your host, Dustin Hoffman.
We're here on Weekend Ag Matters on the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network, and I'm pleased to be joined today by Iowa Agriculture Secretary Mike Nag. Thank you for taking a few minutes to talk with us today.
Absolutely. Good to be with you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. And we're starting what's going to become a monthly thing for us, visiting about what's going on in Iowa agriculture here on the Weekend Ag Matters program. So we're really appreciative of you taking the time to do that.
Well, I'm looking forward to that. And, you know, I think we all know that there's no shortage of issues to talk about in agriculture. If last year taught us one thing, it's certainly that. And so I really do look forward to visiting with you on a regular basis.
And speaking of 2019 and what we learned, obviously USMCA front and center right now. It passed the Senate Finance Committee yesterday as we record this, but it's still going to go to the full Senate where it's expected to pass, but definitely the news we've been waiting to hear.
Well, it is. And that's, you know, one of those pieces of good news as we came out of 2019 on the trade front. Of course, we had a Japan deal that was announced, and then to have the what looked like we were headed for passage of USMCA. Now, we still have another step to go. Great to get it through the Senate Finance Committee. But of course, we're still waiting for that full vote of the full Senate. And unfortunately, USMCA has gotten twisted up, tied up with a lot of the politics in Washington right now and in the House in December. Of course, this is one of those things, a point that we'd been making all throughout 2019, which was don't let this go too long. You know, we don't want to run out of time. And I think, too, there was a real source of frustration for folks in that there's a lot of things that we couldn't control last year, weather being chief among those. But passage of a trade deal that had been negotiated in 2018 that could have been passed through the Congress at any point during last year and could have brought certainty to the marketplace could have helped prices, and didn't happen. It didn't pass through Congress. I mean, that was a real source of frustration. So we'll just keep continuing the push here. Really appreciate Senator Grassley's leadership in the Senate Finance Committee. But as we keep saying, boy, we just need to get this across the line.
You know, and we also talked about this earlier in the year, especially with trade deals. It was like a domino setup. If we could just get one to fall, and we did earlier in the year with Japan, you know, and then all of a sudden USMCA is about to fall, China about to be signed in January. We're starting to see that domino effect go through.
And I think that's that momentum is important. You know, we've been also saying, you know, all throughout this USMCA process that, you know, if we can't, it sends a signal to the to other trading partners, right? If we can't get a deal done with our two closest neighbors and number one and number two trading partners, if we can't do a deal with Mexico and Canada, who can we do a deal with? And so I think that has had a bit of a damper on some of the other trade deals. But as you say, you come through the fall and we have a Japan deal that gets done and goes into effect January 1. We're right on the cusp of having USMCA secured. We are fully expecting that next week we'll have the president signing a deal, the phase one deal with China. This is momentum. I'm excited to think about where we could go. You know, think of it. We only have the U.S. Trade Representative's office, Bob Lighthizer and Greg Dowd. You know, they're people. They've only got so much time in each day. And if they're still trying to get these deals across the line, then that prohibits them or prevents them from going and working on other deals. Now, if we can put a couple things behind us, we can go work on those phase two agreements and work on additional agreements as well.
Now, you had the chance to go with Governor Reynolds over to Japan, and with Japan and China, both of those, you know, we're looking at a phase one deal where, you know, there might be, are they perfect? Maybe not, but there's still time to get some of those other wrinkles ironed out, even for agriculture.
Well, you look at the Japan deal, you know, we don't have a free, as important as a trading partner as Japan is, we don't have a free trade agreement with them. Kind of surprising maybe to some. And so the common thinking is, well, you're going to do, it's going to take you several years to negotiate a deal. We were able to put together this ag deal with Japan in really a matter of months. That's a huge thing. And again, allowed us to address those tariff differentials that we had with TPP countries. And so that's an immediate benefit to us. And we know, and I was in the room when President Trump and Prime Minister Abe signed the intent to do the deal. And just listening to them and listening to the officials from both sides in the room, it was very clear that this was absolutely a phase one agreement, that there would be, we would be addressing additional things and broader business relationships in a full trade agreement. So you're spot on that. Even with the phase one China agreement, it won't address everything that needs to be addressed. We know that. We can be sure of that. But I keep saying, are we better off than we were a year ago? Are we better off than we were a few months ago? We're moving in the right direction. That's promising.
And other things that we also looked at in 2019, you know, renewable fuels had an up and down year. I mean, earlier in the year, we got the announcement E15 year round. That's great news. And then we had the RFS and the waivers and the granting of those waivers. EPA did a complete about face from what everybody was expecting, but yet we aren't surprised by it. I mean, in 2018, Wheeler came to the state fair. He stood right next to you and said, "We're going to fix this problem. Trust me." Trust me seems to be something we're hearing a lot from them.
Yeah, there's just not a lot of trust left in this relationship. And unfortunately, the way that small refinery exemption rulemaking came out, there's a major caveat, which is your EPA saying, you just trust us, we're going to get to 15 billion gallons. Well, you know, now we're saying prove it. And yeah, you know, you go back, you think of 2019, we were riding high. We had great news that E15 would be available year round. That's huge. And in and of itself, if you take away the small refinery exemptions that happened later in the year, we would have had a banner year in terms of policy for renewables. That will drive demand long term. Doing away with some regulatory hurdles to putting E15 through the system will help. We're expecting an infrastructure investment coming from USDA that'll pair very well with what we already do here in the state of Iowa through our renewable fuel infrastructure program. We think we can build more stations, put more pumps and hoses and tanks and all the things in that carry higher blends of ethanol and biodiesel. That's all great news. But then we had the downward trend of that roller coaster, which was those granting of the small refinery exemptions. You know, it didn't go like we wanted it to. It certainly didn't live up to the deal that we thought was cut with Governor Reynolds and Senator Ernst and Senator Grassley with the White House in the middle of the fall. But I think the one thing that the agreement does provide is that EPA does have to consider previous refinery exemptions when they set the blend level for the next year. Now, was that calculated the way we would want it to be using actual waiver numbers? No, but they do have to consider that. And again, EPA also accompanied that deal with a sort of a promise of trust us, we'll get there. We will want to verify that and hold them accountable. And as I said before, prove it that trust can be well placed.
You know, I heard Governor Reynolds so many times say 15 billion gallons means 15 billion gallons.
Right. That is the point, right? And you can talk about mechanisms for reassigning gallons and waivers and partial waivers, but really, really, at the end of the day, are we getting that blend level that Congress mandated, that we expect, that the industry needs, that consumers benefit from, by the way? And that is ultimately what we need to see out of EPA.
All right, as we look ahead to 2020, one thing that people are talking about, farmers are looking at, is hemp. Are we going to be able to produce it? The Farm Bill allows it. Are we going to be able to grow it here in Iowa?
Yeah, you know, this is a topic that I've learned a tremendous amount about in the last 12 months. Of course, we go back, the 2018 Farm Bill opened the door for hemp to be grown in the United States. And what happened next is states then, Iowa, we worked with our legislature and the governor to be able to create, you know, to change our laws to allow for a hemp program. Then we waited throughout the summer for USDA to put out their rules for the hemp program. We got those early fall, and then we submitted our plan for approval by USDA December of last year. So we're still waiting for USDA to give us our approval. Along with that, we've got an open public comment period here at the department for our rules that will dictate our program. So we would encourage folks to visit iowaagriculture.gov and click on the hemp link there, and you can find all kinds of information about what the program will be like, and certainly be able to look at our draft rules as well. But we're still waiting for that USDA approval, but we do expect to have a program in place for the 2020 growing season.
So it'll come down to producers looking at what's going to be a viable marketplace for their hemp once they've grown it.
You know, it's growing it is not an issue. I mean, there's lots of things that folks will have to pay attention to and be concerned about. And of course, all it ultimately comes down to is, is your hemp legal in that it's got a low level of THC? And that's the things that we will be watching with our testing and inspections of the crop throughout the growing season. But, you know, for producers who are interested in getting into this, what I would say is make sure you've got your eyes wide open. That marketplace is really uncertain right now. And so whether it's CBD, which still hasn't been approved by FDA, it's still not legal in the state of Iowa, or whether it's fiber or hemp seed oil, there's lots of things that you can produce, but can you get paid to produce it? And is there a market at the end of the day? That is really what we would encourage folks to be very, very aware of.
All right. Well, Secretary Nag, I thank you very much for kicking off this monthly thing we're going to be doing here on Weekend Ag Matters. We really appreciate you talking Iowa agriculture with us.
Happy to do it, and I'm really looking forward to doing this on a monthly basis.
We'll be back on Weekend Ag Matters on the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network right after the break.
When it comes to managing your crop, you need the best possible advice. Your certified crop advisor participates in ongoing education to keep up with new information and technologies as they become available. Ongoing education and certification maintains the skills of every CCA and gives you access to the latest, most helpful information, making it easier for you to make the best possible decisions. Ongoing education. Reason number 7, you should go to certifiedcropadvisor.org to find a CCA near you.
Welcome back to Weekend Ag Matters, and now here's Ken Root.
We missed an opportunity to move our primary system of measurement to the metric system back in the late 1970s. People rose up against changing from miles to meters and from quarts to liters. For what good outcome? Metric measurements didn't go away, and the United States has incurred more confusion, expense, and self-imposed exile because of unwillingness to unify with a mature measurement system that works worldwide. If the French hadn't invented it, we could probably accept the decimal-based measurement more easily. France was a nation of great scientific achievement in the 19th century and implemented the metric system in 1875. But France fell out of favor due to its wartime actions and rude waiters in the 20th century. As the United States gained dominance following World War II, the diplomatic language shifted from French to English, and we thought all else would follow. We failed to realize the shortcomings of our arcane Roman and Germanic units of measurement that evolved from the length of a king's arm or the width of the rumps of two Roman horses. It was impossible for us to accept changing all measurement except time by establishment of a single unit of measure, the meter, and the single measure of weight and volume, the kilogram. As the French philosopher put it, the metric system was to be for all people for all time. But we said, not us. America's scientific advancement in the 1940s, and especially when we sent men to the moon in the 1960s, boosted our ego to a high level. However, the scientific community, manufacturers who exported, and the citizens who had peacetime interaction with Europe began to favor the metric system until push came to shove in the 1970s. In my humble opinion, we had too much pride and too much bravado to admit something from across the water was better than our own. We stopped legislative attempts to go metric by applying the basic rule of humanity: rich people are never wrong. We argued the infrastructure and legal division of property were laid out in traditional measurements here, so we, the powerful, exerted our influence to allow our system to prevail. For the past century, technology has been the greatest factor in the argument for unifying worldwide measurement. We ship all types of products to every country and have no hesitation to buy industrial machines and vehicles made in Europe, Japan, China, or wherever they are made cheaper or better. As a result, the tools for repair had to be in metric units. That 160-piece socket wrench you got for Christmas is now half metric and half U.S. customary SAE units. The challenge of conversion to the new system is the number of people who know the old one. I contend it won't be hard to parallel measurements for a few years and then convert. Metric units quantify length, area, volume, and mass. We have a number of these measurements already in our daily language. The liter, which is almost exactly a quart. I hear people quote the price for 2-liter bottles as a norm for soda pop. So there can be change, even though there are those who oppose it. Milligram is common in prescriptions for medications. Most news stories about drug busts give the haul in kilos. Kilograms, about 2.2 pounds. So we know it's imported. Kilometers, about 3,281 feet, are the norm for almost all foot races and for Olympic events. Hectares define area and equate to about 2.5 acres. A metric ton is 1,000 kilos or 2,200 pounds or about 39 bushels of corn. The scientific community deals almost exclusively in metric measurements, as do most manufacturers who sell worldwide or buy equipment from foreign sources. The military has to work in both modes as well. The need for collaboration between scientists was shown a bad outcome for a Mars probe in the late 1990s. There is good substantiation for joint U.S. and European projects that it crashed because of a computer software error. In other words, it was sent guidance that confused American measurements with metric, and it came in too close to the planet. A difference between 100 miles and 100 kilometers may not be that substantial, but in this case, it was goodbye to a $100 million spacecraft. Government is making us do so many things that we are sure are bad. Why can't it make us do something that will be good for future generations? Probably the most difficult change in daily life would be the measurements in temperature. The TV stations would need to quote both Celsius and Fahrenheit for several years until we get the hang of 100 degrees from freezing to boiling rather than 180. Road signs would have to show both miles and kilometers for an undetermined period of time. Digital speedometers in vehicles already convert from metric to English. If we had changed the metric system 40 years ago, our view of the world today might be different. We likely would have had more in common and be more inclusive. In dealing with terrorists, for example, we could discuss killing them with 9mm bullets rather than using a .357 Magnum. It's hard to accept that a familiar system is archaic. We laid out the Louisiana Purchase in square miles. How are we going to change that? The landmarks will remain just like the ones all over the world that were pre-metric, and our verbiage will become bi-measurement, just like many are bilingual. The world is becoming more precise and unified. What we memorized in school is not wrong. It's just out of date. Unless you believe God ordained the cubit, or measurements derived from widths of hands or length of arms, moving to the metric system is necessary. That's my view. I'm Ken Root on Weekend Ag Matters.
Thank you, Ken. And that's all for this edition of Weekend Ag Matters. We thank you for tuning in with us here on the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network. You can find replays of this show as well as all of our other content online at iowaagnet.com. Don't forget to find us on Twitter and Facebook at Iowa Ag Radio. On behalf of myself, Anna Hastert, and Ken Root, we thank you for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on Weekend Ag Matters.